Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to Season 2 of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie.
Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
Hey, I'm Christian Sager.
And in this episode, we're going to talk about the work of R. Buckminster Fuller.
Yeah, this guy was a real visionary, primarily influential between the 1930s and 50s. You may have heard of him as an engineer or a designer or sometimes as an architect. He really wasn't any of those things technically. He didn't have the training necessarily, but what he was a major symbol for counterculture and influencing people to be creative. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. As we researched him, and this was a guy that I didn't know a lot about. I mean, I grew up seeing the geodesic domes, some of the geodesic dome houses near where I lived.
Oh, yeah? I didn't know that.
Well, there was one. I say that as if there was a whole
colony like
over there. But there was one up on the hill near where my parents lived.
Oh, cool.
I always tried to imagine what was going on in there.
Yeah. Well, I think I must have heard of him the first time when I went to Epcot Center, because I believe that Spaceship Earth? At Epcot Center is a geodesic sphere. I believe it's based on the principles. I don't think that Fuller was involved in constructing it, but yeah.
But certainly the geodesic dome, the geodesic sphere serves as a symbol for him. It's this, the inspiration of what can be done with engineering and ingenuity.
Yeah, and I think that's very stuff to blow your mind in terms of how much this show has covered retro-futurist kind of aesthetics or engineering principles, ideas, imagination in the past.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and so much of what's appealing about Fuller is that he is just the audacity of some of his ideas. Like some of the other visionaries that we've touched on the show before and we'll touch on in the future, you know, he really thought outside the box, to use a very cliche term. He didn't have all the filters that a lot of us have in trying to envision what we can do with technology and what the future could consist of.
Yeah, and my take on this, I went into this episode being a fan of R. Buckminster Fuller, being very excited about, in particular, the Cloud Nine ideas, which we'll talk about, which are basically flying cities. And I had even written about him for How Stuff Works before, and then really doing a deep dive into the research about him. And in particular, there's an article in The New Yorker that came out in 2008 that's called The Dymaxion Man, and it's by a woman named Elizabeth Colbert. Not Colbert. I believe it's Colbert because it's got a K. Mm-hmm. But it really highlighted his life beyond just the, you know, the big ideas that this guy came up with. And I think that of him now more along the lines of this generation of men who were big thinkers, but were also sort of con artists in a way.
Joe is not going to be delighted.
No, Joe. Yeah. For those of you who know, our third host, Joe, is a big Buckminster Fuller fan, has also written about him. But I'm going to try to convince him. Hopefully he'll listen to this and I'll change his mind. So why don't we start just talking about I'm going to call him Bucky. Okay. Buckminster, I think, is going to be a little bit too much. And Mr. Fuller seems formal for where we're at. So let's call him Bucky. That's what his friends and family called him. He was born on July 12th in 1895 in Milton, Massachusetts, which I'm familiar with from the Boston area. And he died on July 1st in 1983 in L.A. This is like right out of the gate. Like this story of him as a little kid, mm-hmm. I think perfectly illustrates what kind of a human being he grew up into. So he was nearsighted, okay. As a child. So was I. I started wearing glasses when I was 5. But it wasn't until he was actually fitted with glasses, like his parents convinced him, hey, you need glasses. He didn't believe that the world wasn't blurry. He thought the whole world was blurry because that's how he saw it. So I know I'd presented that as a double negative. So he thought the world was blurry. And when they said to him, no, you have something wrong with your eyes, he didn't believe them until somebody actually put glasses on his head and he realized, oh, this is how I'm supposed to see the world. And I think that's a perfect metaphor for this guy's life.
Yeah.
As it goes on, basically.
I mean, I see some of that in my own toddler.
Oh, yeah?
Not to say that he's going to, you know, grow up to be such an iconic figure, but
I wouldn't be surprised.
But there's a stubbornness at times to a kid. You know, they think they know how the world works, and they don't accept the counter argument that you present them with. But maybe that's part of Fuller's vibe, and why he resonates so much is because he kept that that kind of childish vision and assuredness as an adult.
Yeah, I think you might be right. Well, here's another thing. Tell me if your son does this yet.
Okay.
Okay. Buckminster Fuller constantly collected throughout his entire life scrapbooks of his letters, articles, everything as a record of his life. This included receipts for everything, like dry cleaning bills. And we have all of this today. He actually referred to it later on as the Dymaxion Chronophile. he loved coming up with weird names for things.
See, now that sounds a lot more impressive until you realize it has, like, laundry receipts in it.
Yeah. So is your son keeping a Dymaxion Chronophile?
He has a box of rocks. He comes home every day with, like, 6 different rocks in his pocket. So sort of an early stage file-keeping system.
Well, I could see them keeping that in an archive someday. And that's what they did with Fuller, actually. It weighs 45 tons, this guy's archive. So I used to work in an academic library and work a lot with archivists and special collections. And 45 tons is a lot. That's a lot of material. It's the largest personal archive that's currently at Stanford University. So, I mean, I think it's basically everything this guy ever wrote down to paper mm-hmm. he thought was going to be important in some way and kept a copy of it. It's just kind of fascinating. Like, I think about other figures throughout history who, even at a young age, were convinced that whatever they had was going to be so important that one day mankind was going to need to go look back upon these papers. You know, even when you're a child. Theodore Roosevelt was a guy like this, kept a log of pretty much everything he did. And that also, I think, there's a certain amount of narcissism that comes into play there.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, we definitely see that with Fuller, in that he's, from an early point, keeping a file, a holy document of what he is setting out to achieve.
Yeah. So, you know, that's the basics of what we have of him as a child. But like many people in his family, mostly men, he went to Harvard University. Unfortunately, halfway through his freshman year, he took his tuition money and he took it out of the bank and he said, I'm going to use this to entertain chorus girls in Manhattan. story goes that Harvard wasn't pleased about this. He was expelled. A year later, they reinstated him, and then he got thrown out again. We don't know why. Maybe it was chorus girls again. Who knows? But the gist of it is that Bucky never graduated from any college. He doesn't have a degree in engineering. He really, you know, from what it sounds like, he was a book learning man, you mm-hmm. know, which is fine. But I think, like, when you see some of the large scale projects he was hired for later on based on his chutzpah, it makes you wonder. So after this whole Harvard thing collapsed for him, he went on, he took a meatpacking job, then he joined the Navy. When he was in the Navy, this is when he really started his whole, like, invention kick, right? So right. He invented this device to rescue pilots that had, like, you know, crashed at sea. And, what ended up happening was this device often just flipped them upside down and dunked them headfirst into the water and held them underwater.
Right. Well, you know, it expedites the process, but yeah. just not in the way.
Not
that
the way I think the Navy was looking for. Yeah. And then, you know, after World War, or rather during World War One, he got married and he started a business with his wife's father. His wife's father was an architect. And so I think that this is where he, you know, picked up a lot of his knowledge. But the two of them started this business together where they manufactured books out of wood shavings. And I was trying to imagine what this even meant. It's one thing to read that as a sentence in an article. I don't know. What does that mean? They took the wood shavings and they like pulped them down.
I guess it certainly makes me think of you know, homemade paper craft
yeah.
that you see nowadays. But
well, it's hard to imagine, but the company went almost bankrupt. And then somebody bought it from the two of them in 1927. So at this point, this is an interesting point in Bucky's life. And by different accounts from what I read, it's acknowledged differently. Even stories say, like there are interviews with his daughter mm-hmm. saying that this, what I'm about to tell you is probably fictional.
Basically, he comes to a crossroads in his life.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Literally, like his daughter was born. He claimed that at the time he became really depressed because he didn't have a job. He couldn't provide for his family. So he was on a walk. He was walking alongside Lake Michigan and he had suicidal thoughts. And so some versions of this story say that he claims suddenly he was suspended several feet above the ground, in the air, and saw a light, and he heard a voice say, "You do not have the right to eliminate yourself." And then it said, "You do not belong to you. You belong to the universe." And so presumably he was set back down, and he had this epiphany that this was a sign that he should start a lifelong experiment, where basically he should figure out how one person, himself, could benefit all of humanity, could change all of humanity for the better.
And this is where he really started hitting the books, right? Hanging out in libraries, mm-hmm. compiling notes, and really trying to figure out how he can transform the world, right?
Yeah, and he he's keeping, like, documentation of all mm-hmm. of this stuff, right? So rather than go get a job and support his family, he goes to the library. He refers to himself in third person as Guinea Pig B. Presumably B is Bucky.
Uh-huh.
And he starts writing this booklet that he called the 4D Time Lock. From what I understood, it's apparently quite hard to read. The reviews, rather, of it were that it was, the prose was dense. It barely made any sense. But essentially, it's a diatribe about how we were failing at that time in how we constructed modern homes and how we were basically like real estate and construction. And he felt like this was how he was going to impact humanity. He was going to change production, basically, of home life.
And this comes along at a key point too, because we're in this industrialized world, we're seeing these sort of cookie cutter designs roll out in the world around us, but
right.
we're also seeing futuristic visions of what's possible showing up in our science fiction and advertising, and Bucky's ideas kind of serve as a bridge to that.
Yeah, I think that's important to remember, is that, like, there were a lot of people at that time who were having amazing imaginative ideas, mm-hmm. really that, you know, I think that formed what we think of today as sort of our science fiction fantasy conventions,
right.
I guess, right? Like the aesthetics behind that. And Fuller, Bucky, rather, sort of thought of himself, you know, he wasn't in a fictional space. He saw this as, no, this is how we're going to change the real world, no matter how unrealistic it was, or even, as we'll find out later, that he came up with ideas for things that hadn't been invented yet. So his excuse for why he couldn't construct things was, well,
the materials aren't here.
Yeah, sorry, this doesn't actually exist, so I can't make it yet.
Yeah, I mean, he was, like a lot of people at the time, riding that wave of technological optimism, mm-hmm. where it seemed that all these things would definitely come to fruition. And so he's just sort of dreaming ahead of that wave crashing.
Yeah, definitely. So I'd like, before we get into the first of his large, scale inventions, here's a couple other notes about him, just so we've got a framework of Buckminster Fuller as a man. So later on in his life, after he gained some notoriety, he was an academic, and reportedly he could lecture for 10 hours at a time. And that if you had class with him, they lasted from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. And this was not like the kind of like a seminar where you broke out into group sessions and you were interacting with your classmates. Fuller spoke the entire time. He basically just lectured at people for 8 to 10 hours at a time.
But he was very charismatic. So presumably this is, it's not as dreary a 10, it's much as 10-hour lecture.
I get the impression that people weren't falling asleep.
Yeah.
That it was a spectacle to behold. Of course, he believed all the world's problems could be solved by technology. That's basically the philosophy behind a lot of, mm-hmm. of what he saw.
Yeah, he also proposed a clear dome be constructed over Manhattan, a tetrahedron suburb in San Francisco Bay, and he patented a scheme for an underwater city.
So he's really thinking about, I guess, like what we would call today urban studies, right?
Yeah.
Like he was thinking about cities as microcosms of people and how we could put them elsewhere, whether that be the sky, underwater. I don't know why Manhattan would need a dome, but I think this is something that's caught on in fiction because I feel like I've seen it in a lot of other.
Yeah, it definitely shows up in Futurama. There's a.
Oh, really?
At some point, the city of New York is covered in a dome. I don't recall exactly why, but it does happen.
Yeah, well, maybe like acid rain or something like that. Although I don't know that that was what his thinking was. Here's another interesting thing about him. So while he did believe that technology was the, you know, saving grace for all of humanity, he didn't believe in evolution. What he actually thought were that human beings had come from another part of the universe, like another planet, totally as we are right now, and populated the planet Earth, like somebody dropped us off here. He also thought that dolphins were descendants from these, like, proto-humans that came to Earth, and that they had, like, become seafaring proto-humans and eventually turned into dolphins.
I wonder if he ever met up with John C. Lilly. They definitely lived at the same time.
And you were telling me about Lilly earlier, so I think that he sounds like somebody we should definitely talk about on the show.
Yeah,
in the future.
I think we should do a full episode on Lilly at some point because he's a fascinating dude, and we've only really touched on some of his crazier ideas here on the show in the past, and there's a lot more to him than that.
Well, we'll save that for another episode, but here's the last thing I'll give you on Bucky. This is one of my favorites. Before we get into the Dymaxion inventions that he had, okay? For many years, Bucky had a very specific diet, and there were only a few things he would eat, and they consisted of prunes, tea, steak, and Jell-O. Those were like his four food groups: prunes, tea, steak, and Jell-O.
Wow. Well, I think you'd have to put a lot of different things into that Jell-O, to really make that diet work.
Like, I'm trying to imagine. I know that there's a recipe, and I may be taking this off track here, but isn't there something like where there's like a mold of Jell-O where you embed other food products inside the Jell-O, like in suspended animation?
Oh yeah, like little bits of fruit.
Yeah. But in his case, it would just be like prunes and steak.
Oh,
like
you're imagining it all combined.
He just had this one thing that he would eat every day.
Because
he was very utilitarian. He'd want to make it as simple as possible. Okay, so this gives you an idea of what kind of a person Fuller was. He, like I said earlier, he liked to make up words of his own. Mm-hmm. So this leads us to his favorite word that he made up. Well, he didn't make it up, actually, but it was made up. Dymaxion. There was a consultant who was working to sell model homes, and they came up with it. And it's a mash of three words that they thought sounded exciting at the time. Dynamic, maximum, and ion.
Ah, well, it is good marketing.
Dymaxion. Yeah. Yeah, I'd buy that.
But it's perfect for Fuller, right? Because so many of these ideas are about the marketing of the dream and not so much about the realization of it.
Yeah, I think if he were alive today, he would very much be like the kind of madman that would work in advertising or marketing.
Yeah, or just do a lot of TED Talks.
Maybe.
Definitely
a TED Talker. Oh, he would be a TED Talker for sure. You're right. So he took this word, Dymaxion, and he just applied it to a lot of his, you know, invention ideas. The first one was the Dymaxion vehicle. So this was a car that had three wheels. There were two in the front, one in the back, and instead of a rear view mirror, it had a periscope. I tried imagining how that would work. So you would lean over and put your eye in the periscope to see behind you?
I guess so, but of course that's not really too different from what we have now with the rear view video, right?
Oh yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. I've never driven a car with one of those before, but yeah.
It works, but ultimately not too different from a periscope. So I'm going to give him a break on
the
periscope.
Give him a pass on that. Well, apparently this car was really good for like, you know, odd parking maneuvers. So if you're the kind of person who has trouble parallel parking, I think the Dymaxion vehicle was for you. And it was apparently very good at 180-degree turns. But it caused a lot of controversy when it was first introduced. The very first time he put it out on the road in 1933, there was so much hype and people were so surprised by seeing it on the road that it caused gridlock, that people just weren't driving because they were all staring at this thing.
Yeah, I can definitely understand. I mean, I feel like when I see a vehicle that's particularly futuristic driving around town here in Atlanta, it throws me off for a minute and I almost wreck the car.
In fact,
there's somebody near the office here. I see him coming in and out of the Whole Foods parking lot.
Oh, yeah?
In some sort, I don't even know what you call them these days, but it has two wheels in the front and one in the back.
Oh,
so
really?
It's kind of a Dymaxion
like
vehicle.
Yeah. Oh, now I'm curious. You know who we should ask about this is the car stuff guys.
Yeah, Scott, they would know. They would know what this is called.
Yeah. Yeah, I even considered asking them if they had already covered the Dymaxion vehicle. I'm not sure if they have or not, but I'm sure Scott's heard of it before.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first of its kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash.
Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
So Fuller basically envisioned that this vehicle would go beyond the three-wheel model that he had built. He wanted it to fly. He wanted everything he made to fly. That was kind of his thing. But he thought it would be kind of like a duck, the way that it would take off. And that it would also be built in such a way so that, like, when it was on land, it could travel on the roughest roads. But then when there is terrain that you couldn't necessarily get over with, you know, the three wheels on the Dymaxine vehicle, it would just take off and fly over the stuff. Here's what happened with the Dymaxine vehicle. They built one prototype. And it's this one that caused the gridlock, I believe. 3 months after it was released, it crashed. The driver was killed. One of the passengers was seriously injured. But later on, they determined, I believe it was at like a World's Fair that this happened, or something similar to that, like one of these big exhibitions of technology. They determined another car was found responsible for the accident. And they only produced two more of these, and then the whole thing was just put on hold because, you know, it was, again, like many of his ideas, it was a cool idea, but it wasn't exactly practical or functional.
Yeah. As an inspiration and as an argument, it totally works because it's Bucky saying, hey, why does a car have to be this? Let's think outside of the timeline so far. Let's think about what's possible and not just what we have to work with.
Yeah.
But when you start actually, you know, putting a tire to the road, it doesn't always work out.
And I imagine that, like, the investors involved, you know, he must have been a very charming man in order to convince people to put their money into these projects.
Yeah.
And so that leads us to the next Dymaxion invention, which was the Dymaxion house. So that, like the car and some of the other stuff we're going to see later on, he very much had this idea, I think, of, like, everything being kind of like, what we would refer to now as plug and play, right?
Yeah,
like
you just, modular, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you buy it and it's just right out of the box, good to go. And so that's what he wanted this house to be. It was something that you could erect in one day, totally complete. Like, I think furniture and definitely appliances were all built into the structure. They just sort of like unfold and be there. He called it drudgery proof. I don't know what that necessarily meant other than that, like, maybe he thought it would be aesthetically pleasing.
You don't have to go through the rigmarole of building a house, right?
Though, I guess that's true. Yeah. I thought more of that. It was like the drudgery of everyday life, you know, that, that there was something about the home that would kind of put a little spring in your step.
Well, I mean, as a homeowner, it does, like, the home comes to you kind of broken, even if it's, even if you had to build the damn thing, it's in a constant state of breaking.
Yeah.
So this
true.
Is, and you're having to repair it. And then, so maybe the drudgery free home, it's just simply this,
like, if your microwave breaks, you just buy a new home.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the complete modular home. Yeah. Just a complete insert. It's just, if you're, this one's broken, well, great. Just tear the fresh strip off the new one, plug it into your lot, and you're good to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's how he was thinking. I mean, it only really made it to sketch stages at the beginning. What he envisioned was that there were these ultra lightweight towers and that they'd be assembled at a particular location. I guess there'd be like a factory or something where they're making these, and then they would have zeppelins transport them around the world.
I loved that that detail of it.
Yeah,
it's just go ahead and throw airships in there. Like like every idea that he has is tailor made for one of those old popular science covers, right?
Yeah, and this is like straight out of like a pulp novel from the 30s too. Like the way that they would excavate. This didn't actually happen, but theoretically they would excavate sites to place these homes in by just, you know, dropping bombs from the Zeppelin. Just drop a small bomb, just a small one, blow up the area, flatten it out, and then you could put your Dymaxion home down.
Yeah, again, just completely thinking outside of existing context. You know, why not? Why can't we dig a hole in a neighborhood by the use of smart bomb?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And then just drop it, drop the house in there from a Zeppelin.
I wouldn't be surprised if it came back around again, you know, with the way, at least here in Atlanta, with the way real estate prices are going, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, we'll just drop a bomb, knock down a whole neighborhood, and then put a bunch of these. That's basically what does happen, you know, when you think about these, like, live, work, play units that go up in like a year, you know. They're just, really quickly built. Maybe he did inspire some engineers and architects. So the second version of this is the one that ended up like being built, it was shaped like a hexagon, and it was made out of stamped metal, and it was suspended on a mast. The mast, the way I'm envisioning it was like, this was sort of like a telephone pole maybe. And this mast contained all the wiring and plumbing and stuff like that. Today, that's where we'd have our, you know, internet cords and stuff like that. And then when a family moved, they would just disassemble the house and pack it up and move it with them. It basically like another piece of furniture or something like that. And he really only built the scale model that was exhibited in 1929. There was no full-size version ever built because Fuller said the components weren't made yet. There was, you know, the stuff didn't exist yet. I think it went beyond just like the stamped metal and the structure of the thing. I think he was thinking along the lines of like sort of science fiction-y type technology that would come as part of this home. Stuff that we probably consider, you know, normal nowadays, like you know, entertainment center or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, you could of course say the same thing for the Zeppelins and the bomb dropping, right?
Right.
Because you could say that, well, technology just wasn't there yet and still isn't there yet enough to where we would trust, say, a drone to deliver an explosive device
right.
to a neighborhood or, you know, or be able to adequately deliver things via some sort of, you know, a drone Zeppelin scenario.
So, okay, so he didn't have the materials then. We're talking, this is like late 30s, I think. We probably do now. So is this feasible? Is this something that we could do today?
Well, I think one of the big things is that Fuller is very much rebelling against existing notions of what we should have. And he's saying, what can we have? What can we create that'll fulfill those needs? When clearly the rest of us, the non-Buckies out there, are mostly tied to tradition too strongly to say, you know what, I'm not going to live in a house. I'm not even going to live in a modern house. I'm going to live in some sort of a space age tent that I fold up and take with me when I move, you know?
You know, you occasionally see these like kind of articles in science magazines where it's like, hey, look at this home that this one person has built. And it's very much kind of like this, but there's only one of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like a, some sort of like cross between a Winnebago and like a hobbit hole. It's like this,
yeah.
this, you know, amazing idea for a custom built home. I wonder if it's feasible to mass produce them the way that he was imagining.
You got to have demand be there, it's got to be a situation where there's a real need for it. Because one of the applications that has come up at times with some of these designs is, well, you could use it for emergency housing.
Yeah.
You could use it essentially a better take on, say, a FEMA trailer type of scenario.
Yeah, that's true. Here's what I think of it as. You remember in The Fifth Element, the apartment that Bruce Willis lives in that?
I don't remember. I remember it was vaguely Blade Runner-y, but I don't.
Yeah, so it's basically like all the apartments are just like a bed, and then like that folds out of a wall and everything else folds out of a wall. You're basically in like a room that's the size of like a walk-in closet. Mm-hmm. And it's got one window and a door, and they're kind of like stacked on top of each other like crates almost. That's what I keep thinking of when I'm thinking of like the Buckminster Fuller Dymaxion house. You know, like your shower head pops out of the wall in the corner, and then like the house is somehow designed so that all the water drains down immediately. You know, your kitchen surfaces pop out of the sides of the wall. Whatever you need is available, but basically the space is very compact and small, and the actual structure itself is utilitarian.
Okay, so the space transforms to meet your needs at that time. So if it needs to be a bathroom, a toilet pops up.
Yeah,
if it needs to be
exactly.
a bed comes down.
Yeah.
If you just need to do yoga, everything goes into the walls.
Right, exactly. And I don't know if that's feasible either, but some of the architecture I think that we're seeing people experiment with today, we might be heading towards something like that. So he tried to mass produce these, even though they never really got off the ground. He worked together with this aircraft company in Wichita. So this was 1945, sorry. So not the late 30s, mid 40s. He did try to build two examples. They collapsed. The only surviving version of this actually is in the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn, Michigan. So if you're out in Dearborn, you can go see one of these things, see how it worked. We'd love to hear from you guys if you've seen this before in action. I'm sure some listeners have seen one of these, or maybe they'll have seen some of the geodesic domes we're going to talk about shortly. He applied Dymaxion to almost everything. I'm surprised there wasn't a Dymaxion dome, but
there was a bathroom.
Yeah,
we were already talking about Fifth Element bathrooms.
Yeah,
he got in there as well.
So the bathroom was just this single unit that had a built-in shower, toilet, and sink, etc. It was just all, you know, it was basically like a porta potty with like a sink and a shower built into it.
Yeah, and you know, I'm kind of sold on this because so much goes into the modern bathroom. Like there's like, if you build a bathroom onto your house, it gets really complicated really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to worry about like, how far is it? Or you're going to have additional pumps, and there's so many pipes going into it. But if you could just drop something in, if there was just this module,
like Lego.
Yeah. Just this Lego block brought to your house project by a Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Then, why not? Yeah.
Yeah. No,
and the bathroom is one of those key areas where we really don't do a lot of rethinking of the bathroom. So it's prime for a full Bucky redo.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Oh, we could do a whole episode on that.
Oh, yeah. Just, I mean, the audacity of the modern toilet is just ridiculous. So we should be rethinking the toilet more than we do, which makes me wonder to what extent he actually changed how we poop.
Yeah, I'm sure that there was a Dymaxion toilet out there somewhere that reimagined that whole scenario. I know you and Julie had covered something like that previously, right?
Yeah, we talked a bit about the science of pooping. And since that episode, I've become a big advocate of the squat potty. So,
yeah. Well, who knows? I'm sure if he were here today, Bucky would listen.
Yeah, I can imagine he would be a squatter if he were around now. But at the time, the concept might not have been out there enough for him.
Yeah, could have been a little too risque. I mean, flying cities was pretty much as far as he could push it.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh,
yeah. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry, though. He's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And just to run through a couple of other Dymaxian ideas he had, there was the Dymaxian Development Unit, which was essentially a mobile shelter, also described as a grain bin with windows.
And I believe this was something that like the military would use, right?
Yeah.
They'd deploy this in scenarios.
Essentially like a FEMA trailer sort of situation.
Yeah.
And then he also had a Dymaxian map, which is a projection of the world map onto the surface of an isohedron, a 20-sided polygon, which can be unfolded and flattened to two dimensions.
Huh.
Yeah, which
right.
also didn't catch on.
So I'm trying to imagine, this basically looks like a large 20-sided die for D&D.
And exactly.
It unfolds into a map?
Yeah.
Why?
Because it's cool.
Okay. But that's just like the flat map didn't work for him. He needed it.
The flat map.
He wanted to like carry it around.
Yeah, the Dymaxian man can't really roll with a traditional map.
Yeah.
He needs a map that, that looks like it was given to us by aliens.
You're already like thinking in the Madison Avenue, like version of Dymaxian man sales. I like that.
I think it would be a great name for a store.
Yeah.
Shop at Dymaxion, man.
I would not be surprised, because when I was doing research for this, the estate of R. Buckminster Fuller is kept up pretty well. The website's pretty interesting and has a lot of information of it on him of its own. But I wouldn't be surprised if there is somebody who's holding the copyright to Dymaxion right now and just waiting for the opportunity.
Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, again, a lot of these ideas were, according to the man himself, ahead of their time and ahead of even our time. So maybe it's just about waiting for them to come to fruition.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be. Well, here's one that sort of worked. This he didn't use Dymaxion for this. This is the geodesic dome. So this is what most of us probably recognize Bucky's contributions from. So the Dymaxion stuff wasn't successful. So he said, that didn't work. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to invent my own system of geometry. And I'm going to call it synergetic geometry. And he decided that 90 degree angles, he's going to throw those out. It's all going to be based on 60 degree angles. And apparently he hated the number pi. So he didn't like the idea of using that ungainly number to represent, the geometry with the circles. Mm-hmm. So he, even though it works, he said, nope, let's throw that away. We're going to use the tetrahedron as this basic building block for the universe, and everything's going to stem out of that.
Yeah, this is interesting because it brings to mind a number of these different threads in mysticism that apply a lot of mystic significance to the tetrahedron, like a tetrahedron is God. The tetrahedron is having some sort of mathematical mystic significance.
I wonder why that is. I'm sure. Again, this episode I feel like is leading us into like a spider web of other future episodes, but there's got to be some connection there that makes it cross-cultural, right?
Yeah.
Like that it's something that other groups of humans have all come up on their own separately. So he's into the tetrahedron.
Mm-hmm.
He decides that he's going to invent this thing that he calls the geodesic dome. And basically what it is a series of struts, like metallic, I believe, struts that support a skin kind of covering, not actual skin. He's not Buffalo Bill here. It's some kind of a material he's using. But basically, this looks like a sphere cut in half, but it's composed of triangular support. So that's where this tetrahedron stuff comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, he actually managed to parlay the whole Dymaxion failure into a teaching position at Black Mountain College in North Carolina. And he was working with a team of students, and they built one of these as I think part of one of his classes or something like that. And immediately it sagged and fell in on itself. So we're looking at the Dymaxion home all over again. And he claimed that he intentionally wanted this to happen because, a bunch of the faculty at the school were like, oh, there's this wacko Fuller.
Mm-hmm. He just had the whole class build a crazy dome for a semester and then collapsed. What's going on?
Yeah, and they were referring to it on campus as the flopahedron. So he says, no, I intentionally did that because I wanted to know at what point the dome would collapse. You got to figure out the weak structural points of this thing.
He reminds me a lot of the Cat in the Hat at this point because the Cat in the Hat, who I've been reading a lot recently, is always causing a mess, but keeps reframing it as being a part of the plan.
Yeah.
Like, I knew this would happen. I knew that the multiple cats would turn the yard into pink goo. I knew that the thing one and thing two would run wild. But there's a plan here, and everything's going to work out in the end because I know what I'm doing here.
Yeah, Fuller doesn't strike me as a man that was capable of admitting when he was wrong very easily. And that leads us into there was some controversy around all of this. So he actually didn't invent these domes. A guy named Walter Bauersfield had already designed something like this for a planetarium in Germany in 1926. But Fuller got the paperwork done first. So he basically filed, the copyright registration, whatever it was at the time that he was using for this. And so even though, the geodesic domes basically use this method that Bauersfeld had come up with, Bucky held the U.S. patent and popularized the whole idea. And so we think of him as being the inventor for this thing. Having worked on our show, Stuff of Genius, here at How Stuff Works, which is largely about inventors and things they've invented, that is a common story with almost all inventions, that, yes, somebody else invented it, but this person got to the copyright office first. So there was another person as well that, that Bucky essentially took an idea from. This was one of his students who is at Black Mountain College. So part of the idea of these geodesic domes was that they were held together by something that he called tensegrity.
Okay. Again, not a real word.
I don't know. Because from what I read, the way he used the term was that it was a combination of tension and integrity.
Okay.
I think he just like takes words and slams them together.
Well, you know, there's a fine art to creating a good portmanteau.
Exactly. But one of the students from that program, Kenneth Snelson, claimed that he was actually the one who came up with the whole idea for these sculptures, these geodesic dome sculptures, and that he worked on it while he was a student there, but he was under Fuller at the time, and that Fuller then was like, okay, well, here's this is tensegrity. That's what we're going to call it. And he just took off with the idea. So there is, again, some controversy about whether or not any of this. Now, keep in mind, this is like one of the only things that he did that actually sort of worked.
Right.
And so there's controversy about whether or not he even came up with it in the first place himself.
But it did work, and you do see these domes around the country.
Yeah, in fact, you can very easily do a search and look up geodesic domes and see they're used all over the world. Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, the one that is the most famous, I believe it's the U.S. Pavilion for the Expo 67 in Montreal. They built this geodesic dome structure, and there's a lot of people that, you know, it's fairly noteworthy, but I believe that there's some in Japan. You said you're even seeing some in your neighborhood growing up.
Yeah. Just in the middle of nowhere in Tennessee, there's a geodesic dome house up on the hill.
Well, apparently, there was a little bit of problems with these, and one of which was that they all leaked. So I'm curious if the people that live nearby you had problems with leaking, especially like in heavy rain seasons. You couldn't seal them successfully the way that they were designed. Some people even said about ones that they built under Fuller's guidance that they would, add what would you call it, like caulking or some kind of, material in order to cover up the spaces in between the triangles. Mm-hmm. And that would just make it even worse.
All right. So part of the problem here is that you're creating a drastically new house.
Mm.
And with that comes drastically new problems, perhaps, mm-hmm. I mean, it's separate from the sort of evolution of the existing house design. So.
Yeah. And think about it. You've got, what kind of a home would that be like? You're basically just under one huge dome. Like, there's not a lot of ways that you can subdivide that up. I mean, you could, but from what a lot of people have said who have worked on these things, that the acoustics are, as you would imagine, pretty terrible. They just broadcast everything one person says over to the other side of the house. So there's not necessarily a whole lot of privacy there.
Yeah, one of those structures that looks great, I'm sure, as a set for a science fiction movie, but then you start asking questions. Well, like, well, how do we divide these rooms out? And then you're going to have these weird rooms where everything just sort of caves off and into the corner. So again, wonderful concept, but then when you start applying it to real life and reality and our expectations and demands of real life and reality, some of the plot holes begin to show.
But he was able to get people to invest money in this, including his wife. His wife sold $30,000 in stocks that she had to help fund his research so he could keep working on these things, and eventually he built a 50-foot diameter dome that worked. Other than the leaking. Today it is known as, quote, the only large dome that can be set directly on the ground as a complete structure and the only practical kind of building that has no limiting dimensions beyond which the structural strength must be insufficient. So that sounds architecturally fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely lines up with his outlook on life, that technology can achieve all things. And here he has achieved essentially a perfect form, right? It can it works at any given size.
Yeah, and I think the thing about these that is we should point out that's somewhat marvelous is mm-hmm. how light they are for their size, right? So he built one for the Ford Motor Company in 1953. I assume why a lot of his stuff is in the Dearborn, Michigan Museum there. He used aluminum and fitted it with fiberglass, and it was a 93-foot dome, and it only weighed 8.5 tons. So, you know, I'm not a structural engineer, but that sounds fairly light.
Yeah.
So his wife puts in $30,000, Ford Motor Company hires him, and then the Pentagon hires him, and they say, build us this protective housing unit for our radar. So another dome structure that, you know, basically I think they wanted to like keep their radar so it wasn't, the equipment wasn't so obvious from
Like basically instead of a traditional dome, use the geodesic dome and then it'll maybe have a little more structural integrity to it.
Yeah, possibly. And legend has it even Nikita Khrushchev wanted Bucky to come to Moscow and build one of these for him. And Bucky himself lived in one near Carbondale, Illinois, while he was working at Southern Illinois University. So that's the one in particular that I know leaks really badly. That was the one that I read interviews with people who'd worked on the construction of it. And they were just saying, yeah, like, you know, he lived there, lived in quotations. But I think that it wasn't necessarily habitable. So that brings us to the natural extension of the geodesic sphere, which is, I've got this idea for the sphere thing. It's kind of working out okay. I got car companies and the Pentagon giving me money to make more of these. What if I could make these things fly?
Yeah. I mean, he's already expressed an interest in sealing up cities and domes and whatnot. And so this is the perfect extension of his design philosophy. Enclose all of us, enclose a community in this structure that he has dreamed up. And then that structure will simply float up off the ground.
Yeah. So the idea here was that the temperature adjustments inside the sphere would act like a hot air balloon, right?
Yeah.
Like it would be warmer on the inside and subsequently it would float upwards. But that it would be large enough that it could float and have the same quote unquote tensegrity of his domes and also house, you know, an entire metropolis. I'm going to read this part here because this is his explanation of how it works technically, although keep in mind nobody has ever actually built a Cloud 9. So he sees it as a half-mile diameter geodesic sphere that would only weigh 1/1000th of the weight of the air inside of it. So that contributes to why it's able to float. If the internal air were heated by either solar energy or just, you know, average human activity inside producing heat, it would take only 1 degree shift in Fahrenheit over the external temperature of the dome, or sphere rather, to make it float. So the idea here is that the internal air would get denser when it cooled, and Bucky figured, you know, he'd put polyethylene curtains around the outside to slow the rate that the air from outside was entering the sphere. So this is his, you know, he did actually think out some of the math and science around this.
Essentially, it's a space age hot air balloon, except much larger, and would allow us in theory to elevate small communities, not whole metropolises. So I don't think he ever actually argued that, but small towns, mini cities, etc.
Well, you know, he took this idea basically because there was a guy named Matsutoro Shiriki in Japan who challenged him and said, hey, you know, you've got all these big ideas. Here's what I would like to see. Come up with something that can float over Tokyo Bay. And so that's where Bucky basically, you know, really put his effort into this. I believe Shiriki paid him to sort of think this up. But, so they had two names. We're calling them Cloud Nines. That was sort of their nickname. But the official name was the Spherical Tensegrity Atmosphere Research Station, or STARS for short. And his idea was basically like, you know, like with all of his other sort of portable homes or gadgets and inventions, you take these things around, set them up. You know, one idea was that you could anchor them to a mountain. So you've just got this flying home next to a mountain. or you just let them go. Like, let them go like a balloon that flies out of a child's hand, and just the inhabitants would see the world, like, wherever the dome took them.
It's a wonderful optimistic vision, yeah, that was just technology has, I mean, it's the ultimate non-drudgery home, right? You're literally floating free of the world. You're no longer limited by the confines of your environment. You don't have to worry about floods or storm. Well, you probably have to worry about storms. Yeah. But, you know, you can do a little advance notice. You can just float to a storm-free area, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's the idea.
Call over the nearest Zeppelin.
I don't
schedule it.
Yeah. Just
schedule a Zeppelin.
You got a Zeppelin coming by to drop some bombs to build some homes. They just zip by, tug you along. I don't know. I don't know how he envisioned controlling the direction these things went in. I didn't read anything about like propulsion or anything like that, but maybe it was just all that fascination with Zeppelins at the time. He would have been like a steampunk cosplayer nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of surprised I don't see this idea replicated in science fiction. I mean, I assume it has been used somewhere because Buckminster was just too influential you'd think it would be showing up in video games left and right. You
know? I worked on something once that wasn't published where there was a Cloud Nine in the story.
Yeah.
And this was before I had started working here and done some really deep research on Fuller. And I believe, I want to say it was something by Warren Ellis that I had read where he had envisioned using Cloud Nines for something. Yeah. That it sort of inspired me.
And you certainly see this concept employed elsewhere with other individuals who are thinking about, you know, the possible, you know, applications for this kind of technology. In particular, a 1971 edition of Technica Molodezy, which was essentially Soviet-era popular science magazine.
Okay.
And you see this concept for colonies in the upper atmosphere of Venus, because of course, the planet Venus at surface level is just a poisonous pressure cooker. You know, it's not hospitable in the least for human life. But conceivably, if you were to have some sort of a floating structure, you could just place it in the upper atmosphere, and there we would be able to live, you know, artificially, not out in the open, but with a little more Earth-like conditions.
And it's so like Cloud City in Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah, I mean, I was never sure exactly how Cloud City was supposed to float in that.
I don't remember either.
Just science magic propelling it. But this particular concept in the Soviet publication would have used a very similar design using, depending on the buoyancy of the atmosphere, enclosed in a giant sphere.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, the drawing for that is fascinating, and you posted that onto the Stuff to Blow Your Mind site already, right?
Yes, and I'll be sure to include a link to that post on the landing page for this episode.
Okay, great. Yeah, everybody go take a look at that, because I think it gives you a pretty good idea of how humans would turn a flipping sphere like this into a little microcosm, you know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of remind me of like a submarine.
Yeah. And it's very much in keeping with the Fuller design philosophy of, like, here's something we could do, potentially can do, but there are a lot of steps that would need to get checked off the list before we actually got to floating cities.
Well, and that was basically his, you know, end thesis on the whole thing was, he even said, like, all right, this is not an idea that I know how to actually bring about. He called it a exercise to stimulate imaginative thinking. And so, you know, he thought it would eventually be possible to do this, but he didn't see how they could be constructed until his far future. Mm-hmm. I don't know how far in the future he meant. Maybe it's today. Maybe it's 200 years from now. I don't know. So, you know, that's a good round summary of Fuller. There's, you know, more to him than the wacky inventions that we didn't really get into today. He is noted as being what we refer to today as somebody who would be like a green philosopher, take note, like the solar energy aspect of the Cloud Nines. That's how they would be heated, not with gas or other fossil fuels. And he's also, you know, seen as being a social theorist, too. So some people see him as really thinking ahead of time about human, again, like what I was saying earlier, like I think he would be like a great urban studies professor today.
Yeah. He seemed to think a lot about, you know, where technology meets humanity, and not just, you know, not just about what's come before, but also what we can do with it, and what needs need to be met by our technology.
Yeah. Well, Okay. I went into this, wanting to love him. I think I learned a little bit more about his background, and it made me less convinced of him as an inventor necessarily. Mm-hmm. But, even though only a few of his ideas have come to fruition, you know, he has influenced counterculture to quite a degree, social thinking as well. And, a lot of Silicon Valley's pioneers list him as being one of their biggest inspirations.
Yeah, and ultimately that's his contribution, is that he was a dreamer, and he was an optimist when it came to technology and design. And so that's his greatest gift, is he passes this design philosophy on to individuals who can either take those dreams a little further or figure out how to realistically apply them in a beneficial way.
Yeah, the practical applications. Yeah. Maybe that's something that comes after his life.
Yeah, you got to have somebody throw out the dream, and then somebody else needs to make it, figure out how to make
it work.
So
maybe he's not as much of a con artist as I made him out to be at the beginning of the episode.
No. But yeah, I don't think of him as a con artist as much as... Yeah, a dreamer who, like his proposed Cloud Nine, is floating a little bit off the air. Well, like his vision that he experienced of floating and being told that his life is not his own.
Oh, yeah, look at that. Those all connect, the floating.
He's literally, in this sense, an architect and engineer who doesn't have both feet on the ground.
Yeah.
But that's why we love him, because he's thinking free of those restraints.
Absolutely. So there you have it. That is our Buckminster Fuller.
Indeed, a dive into who he was, why we're still talking about him today, and what some of his more out there ideas and encouraging ideas consisted of.
So if you are out there and you have seen some of these inventions in real life, I'd love to hear about it. Or even maybe, see photos or something like that, if you could send them to us on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, where we are Blow the Mind on all of those platforms.
And, of course, the mothership floating high above the surface.
Our Cloud Nine.
Yeah, is stufftoblowyourmind.com. So check that out for all the podcast episodes, all the videos, all the blog posts, links out to those social media accounts, you name it.
And you can always contact us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie.
Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
Well, how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.